Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Krupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Congolese government forces killing at least three dozen rioting Burundian refugees. Reports allege that the refugees began rioting in opposition to Kinshasa's plan to send them back to their home country, and that the situation quickly got out of control as they started throwing rocks, attempting to break some of their compatriots out of jail, and, in an unverified claim, might have even seized a weapon and killed a soldier. This prompted the military to set their guns on the rioters, and over 100 people are thought to have been injured, aside from the at least 36 who were killed. The incident did make rounds on the international news circuit, but was mostly overshadowed by the Rohingya crisis, even though it shouldn't have been. There are almost near equal numbers of Burundian refugees as there are Rohingya ones, at roughly 400,000 each. But the world is paying considerably more attention to the latter, because of the optics and geopolitics involved, while ignoring the former for the same reasons. To explain, Myanmar is a crucial component of China's One Belt, One Road global vision of new Silk Road connectivity, and it's accordingly emerged as a hybrid war battleground as a result. The Muslim faith of the Rohingya makes them more easily presentable as victims to the eyes of the global public, especially considering that it's majority Buddhist government forces that they're fleeing. Their cause could also theoretically appeal to the over 1 billion Muslims across the world, which is important for perception management reasons and the soft power objectives of the international forces leading the pro-Rohingya cause. On the other hand, the Burundian refugees have no such significance in international politics. They share the same religion as their own government and the people of the surrounding East Central African region, and they serve no cynical role in obstructing any Silk Road project aside from catalyzing domestic unrest in the host states. Moreover, comparatively fewer people across the world even care about what's happening with them. To touch upon that, many Burundians fled their country over the past 2 years when the rebel members of the Tutsi minority rose up to try and overthrow the government in the run-up to President Nkurunziza's controversial election to a third term in office. Some of the Hutu majority are also rebels, but generally not in the same groups as the Tutsi, which were suspected of having the full backing of the Tutsi-led minority government in neighboring Rwanda. The situation has largely stabilized over the past year, and there is no longer an imminent risk of an ethno-tribal civil war taking place, which is why the Congo sees no need to continue hosting Burundian refugees in one of the poorest corners of the already impoverished and conflict-prone Central African state. Although the Burundian refugees rioted in response and were killed by the military when they got out of control, the mainstream media doesn't really care too much about their cause anymore, so it was basically ignored. Contrast that with the global scandal that could have been expected had Rohingya refugees rioted in Myanmar or Bangladesh and were killed by the military in response, which could have served as the excuse for launching a so-called humanitarian intervention. It's politically incorrect to say, but all refugees are not created equal, no matter what the media says, and the only ones that turn into international causes are those who serve an immediate geostrategic agenda. The next one up is the EU proposal for a so-called investment screening framework. President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, suggested this initiative last week in response to the purchase of EU member states' strategic assets by foreign countries, and the idea, if implemented, will give the host state the ability to intervene in stopping the deal if it's carried out by foreign state-controlled or state-financed enterprises. Although China wasn't mentioned in the context of Juncker's speech, Beijing felt that it was indirectly being targeted by this move and therefore publicly protested against it, with Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Qing decrying it as protectionism, which only serves short-term interests at the expense of long-term ones. China's reaction was predictable because it's been Beijing's strategy to purchase strategic assets all across the world, and it therefore feels like its own interests would be threatened if the entire EU adopted Juncker's proposal. Some states, both inside the EU and beyond, already have such legislation in place for national security reasons, because they're afraid of high-level technology transfers to the purchasing party and the potential for the buyer to leverage its control over the said assets to influence the policies of the host country. There's a certain logic behind this, which makes it very plausible. And given the fears all across the Western world that China is doing just that, it's understandable why the EU would, in principle, want to move in a semi-protectionist direction. That said, there are also ulterior motives as well, the most probable of which may be that the bloc wants to create the legal pretext for keeping its Chinese competitors out of the strategic dimension of its member states' economies, thereby making the bloc's German, French, and Italian leaders the only ones who could realistically bid on such offers. At the end of the day, this proposal will not prevent the sale of strategic economic assets for whatever reason a given company may have for putting them on the market, but it will just allow the host government to regulate who is allowed to buy them. With it strongly being inferred that this initiative is aimed against non-Western state-linked companies, which could be broadly interpreted in its present form to mean any economic entity which receives any amount of government funding whatsoever, the possibility reasonably exists that this is really just a front for denying the EU's competitors access to the bloc's strategic assets, and making it much more likely that they'll be purchased by a member state's company, such as Germany's, instead. Although the idea is sound in principle and makes sense on both the national security and populist levels, it's still really just a hybrid war instrument for containing China. Third on our countdown is Venezuela de-dollarizing its future oil contracts and switching to euros and yuan instead. The move comes after the U.S. tightened sanctions against the hybrid war beleaguered Bolivarian Republic, and can be seen as a clever asymmetrical response designed to hit the U.S. where it hurts, the petrodollar. One of the main reasons why the U.S. was able to ascend to its preeminent global position was because the sale of oil has always been conducted in its currency. But there have been tepid moves to de-dollarize this and other aspects of the world economy across the past decade or so. Venezuela's decision is one of the boldest thus far, however, since the country is a member of OPEC and has the world's largest oil reserves in the Orinoco River Belt. This led to many people worrying that the U.S. will escalate its hybrid war on the country, just as they did against Gaddafi when he proposed selling oil in euros and then creating a new gold dinar currency for industry-wide transactions. These fears are well-founded, and it's likely that Trump will try to make President Maduro pay for what he's done in one way or another. Instead of speculating on the specific forms that this could take, it's more pertinent to examine how Venezuela's decision fits into the larger paradigm of de-dollarization. The BRICS countries, and especially the core strategic partnership of Russia and China, have been pushing ahead with conducting commercial, investment, and energy transactions with one another in national currencies. But this has yet to generate the crucial inertia that's needed to implement fundamental, system-wide reforms in the global economy. It'll take time for this to happen, and it's precisely in this interim, transitional period that the U.S. is pulling all of its various destabilization levers, from sanctions to hybrid wars, and even economic espionage in an attempt to prevent this. What wasn't expected, however, was for a major OPEC member to suddenly announce that future oil contracts would be conducted in euros and yuans, as this accelerates the de-dollarization process by giving it a renewed impetus. It also encourages other energy exporting countries, whether OPEC members or not, to consider following suit. That's precisely why the U.S. will probably punish Venezuela soon enough, because it's scared that the demonstration effect of allowing this to happen with impunity will soon catalyze a chain reaction all throughout the industry. It might surprise some people to hear this, but stereotypical oil giant and long-standing American ally, Saudi Arabia, might be on the verge of de-dollarizing future energy contracts as well, at least if one considers just how close it's become to China over the past year, after Beijing signed over $110 billion worth of deals with it in just the last 6 months. China, more so than any other country, wants to see de-dollarization succeed as soon as possible in order for the yuan to become a more competitive global currency for all transactions, whether energy or otherwise. So it might predictably lean on Saudi Arabia to seriously contemplate doing this in exchange for Beijing having invested billions of dollars into its economy. Russia and Iran are also interested in de-dollarizing too. So if, and that's a key qualifier, the right amount of multilateral coordination is present, then this might become a game-changing reality sooner than later. Our runner-up is Saudi Arabia arresting between 16 to 30 people in a broad crackdown across the kingdom. According to reports, this crackdown is notable because it includes a wide variety of seemingly disparate individuals, such as clerics, a journalist, and even a prince, and comes amid a flurry of speculation that King Salman is considering abdicating in favor of the young Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Critics claim that this is being undertaken in order for Salman's successor to preemptively consolidate power and staving off any unrest that might result from his possibly imminent ascent to the throne. While the government says that it was actually dismantling a foreign intelligence network linked to the Muslim Brotherhood and Houthis, Riyadh's assertions are a thinly veiled euphemism to suggest that Qatar and Iran are behind the shadowy regime change plot. But it's very unlikely that either of them is involved. And Riyadh may have just said they were in order to diplomatically deflect attention from the true culprit. Here's why. Iran and Qatar are close with Russia and China, and the latter two great powers are actually enjoying a renaissance of relations with Saudi Arabia right now. While one might expect this to make Tehran and Doha jealous, the opposite is true. Moscow and Beijing is developing high-level strategic partnerships with Riyadh are designed to bring balance to the Mideast by weaning the kingdom away from Washington and slowly but surely integrating it into the emerging multipolar world order, which will never be perfect or without friction, but is still a step in the right direction. In order to appreciate what's happening, one needs to be reminded of a few things that have happened this past year when it comes to Saudi Arabia's relations with Russia and China. Concerning Moscow, Riyadh agreed to an historic OPEC output deal with Russia last year and renewed it a few months ago after it expired. The Saudis are also cooperating with the Russians in encouraging the Syrian so-called opposition to merge into a unified entity for facilitating peace talks with Damascus. Foreign Minister Lavrov was just in the kingdom last week, and King Salman is expected to visit Moscow sometime next month. As for China, Beijing sent a total of over $110 billion worth of deals with Saudi Arabia in the past 6 months alone in an effort to assist the Crown Prince's ambitious Vision 2030 program of economic modernization. It's that initiative, more so than anything else, which holds the danger of inadvertently destabilizing the country's internal affairs because of the opposition that it's come under from some of Saudi Arabia's many radical clerics who are against the social consequences of its reforms. Bearing all this in mind, it's worthwhile to revisit the question of who has an interest in destabilizing Saudi Arabia right at the moment that is turning away from the U.S. and towards Russia and China, timing their subversive efforts to coincide with a prolonged leadership change and an economic transition. By all indicators, those aren't the hallmarks of an Iranian or Qatari operation, but the red flag for an American one. At our top spot, we've got Russian energy giant Rosneft's plan to build a Kurdish-Turkish gas pipeline to the EU. Rosneft revealed that it was in negotiations with the government of Iraqi Kurdistan to construct the pipeline by 2019 and then begin exporting gas a year later, thereby shedding some light on what the government-owned Russian company had in mind when it signed a major deal with the autonomous region in June during the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. The pipeline's exact route is still uncertain, but it will probably either travel overland through Turkey and then link up with the Turkish stream infrastructure near the EU border, or terminate in the Eastern Mediterranean with an LNG export terminal, the latter of which could facilitate shipments to Israel and strengthening Russia's already close partnership with Tel Aviv. All these possibilities are very interesting and add a new layer of strategic depth to Russia's Mideast energy diplomacy. But what's important to focus on in the near term is how the timing of this announcement came exactly 1 week before the Kurds' controversial independence vote and just a day after Russia re-established direct flight service with Iraq, of which the Kurdish regional government is nominally a part. None of this was a coincidence, as it sent several strong messages to the international community at a very crucial time in the Mideast history. The first one is that Russia deals with Iraqi Kurdistan as if it were already an independent country, bypassing Baghdad in conducting bilateral energy diplomacy with a breakaway statelet despite officially recognizing the central government's sovereignty over the entire state and its resources. Russia's reason for doing so seems to be that it sees an irresistible opportunity to indirectly improve relations with the EU by providing Kurdish-sourced and Turkish-transiting gas to the bloc's Southern Energy Corridor project, which could work out both to Moscow's own strategic benefit and also to the Kurds by giving two of their opponents a reason to recognize their future independence. This leads to the next point, which is that Russia's hefty strategic investments in the Kurdish energy sector make Moscow a major stakeholder in the territory's future, which in turn allows Russia to stage a diplomatic intervention in becoming the mediator between Erbil and Baghdad and the Kurds and their three international neighbors in a bid to protect its interest. This aligns with the view of Russia's foreign policy progressives, who envision their country's 21st century geostrategic role as being the supreme balancing force in the Eurasian supercontinent. And to that end, they've sought to flip traditional U.S. allies to their side by encouraging their multi-alignment, or foreign policy diversification, with Moscow. The Iraqi Kurds are just the latest example of this happening, coming after Turkey, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan, all of which proves that Russia's so-called pivot to Asia is actually a pivot to the Ummah, as Moscow steadily works to replace the leadership void that the U.S. is leaving in the greater Middle East. Right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you all will tune in again next week, and I hope you guys have a nice weekend. Thanks. Bye.